Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast. Hello, and welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. It's me, Matthew Wade, this week all on my lonesome because everyone else is too busy. But there's quite a lot to discuss in Arsenal land. I'll try and rattle through it to make sure you don't get too fed up of my voice if you're listening to this. But actually, there's quite a lot of issues going on outside of the actual football results itself, which is probably just as well, given that last week's football result was rather disappointing. The 3-1 defeat at home to Manchester United in the FA Cup probably wasn't the most surprising result, given their turnaround in form, as they now have a manager that makes them realise that they are good players and doesn't make them feel like shit, and they don't all hate him, and suddenly they're beginning to reap the benefits of having spent £500 million in the last 4 years on their squad, on top of a squad which was already regularly in the top four. The game plan that Manchester United set up with was what they've been doing most of the time away from home since Solskjaer took over, which is playing that incredibly pacey front line on the counter-attack, something that Arsenal have been vulnerable to for a number of years, slightly less so this season in certain fixtures. But then when you've already got your first-choice left-back, your first-choice right-back, and one of your first-choice centre-halves injured, and then you lose two other centre-halves within the course of a game, it does make you rather more open to a counter-attack. The key thing was, I suppose, initially the first injury to Socrates, which totally undermined Arsenal's momentum, who had been the better team up to that point and probably created the closer opportunities, if not clear-cut chances. Arsenal completely lost momentum, and then Man United caught us twice on the counter-attack, partly because we still don't have a midfielder that can keep up with someone like Pogba in the midfield. And let's face it, when Paul Pogba is used properly, he is a fantastic footballer. The continuation of Jose Mourinho looking like a fucking idiot is quite pleasing, despite the fact that it has resulted in us having a much greater challenge for European places next season and also being knocked out of the FA Cup. We've all seen this game before. Arsenal have a lot of possession, try and control the game, but ultimately are not defensively solid enough to play against an absolutely top-draw counter-attacking team, which Manchester United are at the moment, which, given, you know, that front line's going to frighten most people. I mean, hey, people can talk about who they didn't play, but Alexis Sanchez and Romelu Lukaku still did cost, in terms of value, £100 million between the two of them, and collectively earn about £700,000 a week. And given that the Arsenal fans stupidly booed Alexis, it was always likely that someone of Alexis's character was going to then score against us, particularly in this new attacking Manchester United setup. And also, you know, you don't make someone who is feeling down in the dumps more determined to do well against you when they're that talented. And ultimately, that was one of the things that cost us. We still have issues, obviously, throughout the squad about a lack of imbalance, a lack of proper width. Manchester United did pretty much what West Ham did, which was kind of like, well, they've got no Bellerin now, so they're going to be coming down their left, and they just clogged that up and made sure there was no space for the likes of Aubameyang to run in behind. And Arsenal, once they went the two goals down, were largely bereft of ideas, despite a valiant effort, I suppose, from the players. And Man United, I mean, it played perfectly into their hands. They just dropped Pogba a few yards deeper. And they just dropped 10 yards, as I say, further back, and played even more on the counter, which was basically get the ball to Pogba, let him run, and then play it to their wide players or their front man and just run at the Arsenal back line, which already massively depleted, was getting steadily more depleted during the game. The real nail in the coffin was the injury to Koscielny. Again, we had a head of steam of sorts building up, and the game was in the balance. It was 2-1, and we were probably pressing quite effectively, but we couldn't get any momentum going after that. And obviously, it removed our ability to make certain tactical changes going forward and left us much more open to the counter-attack for what was ultimately Man United's third goal. I've heard a lot of people after the game being very critical of the manager, and of course, as results have taken a downturn, you can expect that, but you know, given that the British press are risking themselves blind because Spurs have got three or four players out, and yes, they are high-quality players, given that Arsenal are now missing five of their first-choice back four and have had struggles with injuries up out wide in an attacking midfield, that's no basis for a team, particularly when you have much more limited resources than anyone else in the top six apart from Spurs. It's noticeable that as soon as Spurs have two or three injuries, they drop out of two cups in the space of a week and start losing ground in the league after what had been a great season so far for them. Ultimately, injuries are incredibly difficult to deal with if you have limited resources, and Arsenal, as we are being reminded every 5 minutes in this transfer window, do have limited resources. I mean, it's hard to say too much more about the game itself. United were worthy winners. They had the better players to choose from, and they took their opportunities more with, well, clinically, shall we say, even if they were afforded more space to be able to do so. It's the kind of game that, as we've seen a number of times in recent years under Arsene Wenger, exposed the weakness in the squad, and frankly, Emery doesn't have the players to be able to counter-attack some of those weaknesses. Yes, he was able to shut up shop against a rather toothless Chelsea, but ultimately, when the best teams are going to coming at us with multi-hundred million pound front lines, it's hard to combat when you're cobbling together what was a very disjointed squad that was built with a very scattergun approach and has been riddled by injury on and off for the last year. I think we have to be philosophical about it and hope that an FA Cup run at least manages to distract Manchester United from their league ambitions. I don't know. Maybe they can pick up a few injuries again like they had earlier in the season. But as for Arsenal, it really focuses on our mind. It's the Europa League and the league, which had to be our priorities anyway. Chelsea's going to be interesting to see how they go in that race for the top four with new signing Higuain. But once again, they teach us how it's done by getting such a vast amount of money for Alvaro Morata when that deal actually goes through. As we've touched on previous podcasts and in previous articles, Arsenal's ability to sell players for what they're worth has been less than appalling. Looking at Arsenal's ability to try and improve the squad going forward, we're fully aware of the financial limitations, whether they're absolute limitations or whether they're just strategic limitations due to uncertainty about the direction of the team, who they can offload, and perhaps even some uncertainty at board level about what the composition of the support staff managerial structure is going to be in the next few months. I mean, I can see, I've heard lots of conspiracy theories, and I can see why people are very annoyed about the situation. We don't know if it is a genuine limit or if we know it's a, or if it's a self-imposed limit. But given that the head of recruitment is departing and they're looking to hire a new one and bring in a new technical director at some stage, you can understand why the club are reluctant to invest big in this transfer window, given A, that one seldom gets good value in January, and B, the fact that we're already very, very close to our potential limits when it comes to the wage limits on financial fair play. Or the Premier League version of financial fair play. So, obviously, people might want to see who can be offloaded in the summer before they make any major spending commitments. Hence the reason for wanting to bring in players on loan with options to buy rather than obligatory fees, which obviously seems to have made the Denis Suarez deal fall through as far as our dealings with Barcelona are concerned. And I think as a club where Arsenal are at the moment, unless there's someone that you're absolutely sold on, bringing players in on loan to sort of try before you buy does seem like quite a wise option, particularly given that some of our issues that we have at the moment are medium term as opposed to long term. I mean, Emery in his press conference today was talking about how we are looking to bring in a couple of players, but they probably won't be in defence. And obviously I can hear people screaming why. Personally, would quite like it if we could convince Chelsea to send us Gary Cahill on loan for the rest of the season just so we have a fit body there. Yes, he's limited. Yes, he's not as good as he was. But ultimately, at this stage, we have precious little choice. But the flip side of the coin is that we do have a full selection of centre-halves. It's just that three of them are injured at the moment. And the fourth is on a loan that we can't recall them back from. So actually, we might have six first-team central defenders come the summer anyway. So buying a seventh and a long-term deal, unless you think that they are actually going to be a long-term option for the club, is a strategy I can see why people would think they'd want to avoid. The same goes for the right-back situation. We've been linked with Kevin Malquitt. I've never heard of him before, who's been playing for Napoli this season, previously of Saint-Étienne, an attacking right-back, which makes sense given the absence of Bellerin and how important he is to our tactics. And we've also been linked to a guy called Mandy, I think, from... which Spanish team is it? I'm going to have to look this up. Do bear with me. I can't find it. Anyway, there we go. I think it's Betis, if I remember. Yes, that's it. It's Real Betis. He can play centre-half as well at a push. But again, the argument has to be, unless he doesn't come back from his injury, Bellerin's going to be our number one right-back next season. We've got two other right-backs who aren't the quality that we want, but we have two right-backs who we can't sell. They're going to probably be leaving in the summer. So it doesn't make a massive amount of sense for us to bring in another body when we have squad size limitations, when we do actually have other players who can play in that position. You know, the unlikely olive branch to Carl Jenkinson that no one would have seen coming a few months ago is there, and it's a chance for him to, you know, either earn himself a short extension to his Arsenal contract if he does well, or more likely earn himself a better role at another club down the line, given that he now seems to be fit again after two or three years of really bad injury problems. You know, it's a real opportunity for him. And of course, we've got Ainsley Maitland-Niles that can fill in there. And some of the players that we've been linked with for other positions can also potentially do a job there as a wing-back role. More on that in a short while. So it's all very easy to talk about the transfers we want and the players we want to bring in. But ultimately, as anyone that's played Football Manager knows, you do have a 25-man squad limit for players over the age of 21, at least eight of whom have to be homegrown, at least four of whom have to be homegrown at the club. Arsenal, at the moment, do not have a lot of flexibility in that department, particularly with Welbeck injured and likely to depart and Ramsey leaving. We're going to have a problem when it comes to homegrown players, and our only real wiggle room to grow is in that category of homegrown players. So we can only really bring in maybe one or two people to replace people who are injured to be able to make the squad work. I mean, we simply do not have anywhere to put five incoming players unless three or four depart. It's a strange limitation, again, as it seems to benefit those teams who can spend the most money, because obviously there isn't a massive price premium on homegrown players, regardless how good they are, which again illustrates just how fucking stupid Arsenal's policy has been in the last few years of letting homegrown players of a Premier League international standard leave the club for absolute peanuts or nothing. But, you know, that's the Even Gazidis Wenger era, and there's nothing that can be done about that. Ultimately, the cock-ups are done. That is water under the bridge, and it's all that really matters is how we move forward. Now, looking at moving forward, it's interesting to see the players that we're linked with as the club, even if some of them are not going to happen because they're linked about on loan, and clubs understandably do not want to just loan you first choice play or first team players with no guarantee that you're going to be keeping them. But there is a certain commonality between all the players, even though they are very different, which is that they all have greater positional flexibility than has been traditionally the case in the Arsenal squad in the latter years of the Arsene Wenger reign. You look at it, and Arsene was always great at buying undervalued players who could play in one at a maximum two positions and who were real specialists to fit within his strategy, which is when you had the best players, or you had certainly a stronger squad and the Premier League wasn't suddenly invaded by billionaires and oil barons. It worked great because you could get this finely tuned machine that, you know, as long as you didn't have too many injuries, everyone's jobs were created to work well with each other. As those financial advantages appeared in a lot of other teams, and as we could no longer afford to compete in the transfer market and therefore had to buy a lower profile, a low ability of player, the reliance on specialists or people with specialist role started to be less effective, because ultimately it meant as soon as you had some injuries, the entire structure of the team fell apart. As we, you know, the most obvious example of that is the Cazorla-Coquelin partnership, where as soon as Cazorla got injured, Coquelin was no longer an option really as a first choice, because he wasn't good enough on the ball to play in a double pivot unless he was with someone like Cazorla, who was a brilliant two-footed passer who could beat a man, break through the lines and all the rest of it, and give that creative opportunity to get the ball to people like Mesut Ozil in positions where they actually wanted the ball. In the same way that Arteta and Ramsey worked as a partnership, because Ramsey was the legs, that endless movement, and Arteta was brilliant at controlling the tempo, a good passer, again between the lines, but also a very smart player positionally, even though his legs had started to go towards the end of his time at the club. Unai Emery is a very different creature. He craves tactical flexibility, he craves pragmatism. It's defined a lot of his time at Sevilla, even though he clearly had his favoured systems, and it defined some of his best results with PSG. I mean, everyone always talks about PSG bottling second legs against Real Madrid and Barcelona, but that was partly because that external interference made him change the tactical setup he had. When your captain basically goes above your head to the owner every time you make a tactical decision he doesn't want, it does make things difficult for you. And when he was actually picking for the first legs of those ties, he did a brilliant job and totally outfoxed both Real Madrid and Barcelona. The only reason the collapses became so spectacular is because they'd done so well in the first legs. Now, obviously, I have no sympathy for PSG. They are now become an evil artificial construct based on the accumulation and spending of wealth. But Unai Emery, as a manager, has shown that he's at his best when he has a squad of players that he can deploy in different ways, preferably during games. You look at this Arsenal squad here, and the squad he inherited does not have a great deal of positional flexibility. Aubameyang can theoretically play wide as well as up front. Lacazette even more theoretically wide. Yes, he started there, but hasn't played there in 7 or 8 years. Ozil is number 10. You can use him elsewhere, but it doesn't really achieve very much. Ramsey is this kind of advanced number 8 that isn't really a number 10, can do a job at a number 8, but isn't really defensively strong enough in the system that Emery wants to play, where the fullbacks are really giving you a lot of attacking prowess. And again, you look at central midfield, you've got Granit Xhaka, who has been forced to play other positions this season, but basically has one position. Lucas Torreira who was an incoming player, can at least play two different midfield roles. Iwobi can possibly play both flanks at a push, but he's half the player on the right that he's on the left and isn't really a number 10. He may yet become a sort of 8.5 ball-carrying attacking midfielder, but we'll have to see how that development continues once the squad is shaped a little bit differently. Certainly, he's done a better job of being a threat out wide this season under Unai Emery's coaching and actually getting in behind the opposition fullback, but he can't play all over the pitch. I mean, I could go through the whole squad. Essentially, the only players we have that have genuine tactical flexibility are Ainsley Maitland, I'll play anywhere, Niles. And I suppose you could make a case for Nacho Monreal, who can play left centre-back, left-back or left-wing-back. The rest of them is pretty much they play in one or two positions, which means that if you want to change things during a match or if you want to change things during the course of a season with these limited squad sizes, you don't have a lot of flexibility. But you look at the players we're being linked with. Okay, Ivan Perisic seems to be a reaction to not being able to get Denis Suarez, but he at least could play both flanks, is very two-footed. I'm not sure he represents good long-term value for Arsenal, but he's certainly a player that can offer something in position that Arsenal need, a player to offer something. Denis Suarez, the aforementioned, can play central midfield, attacking midfield, left wing and right wing. Again, I'm not sure he's top draw in any of those roles, but he can at least fulfil different roles in the pitch because he is a good passer and a good dribbler. He's actually quite a good finisher, but hasn't yet formed the instinct of getting into goal-scoring positions enough, which is a shame as it limits the benefit of his skill set. Elsewhere, one that I'm particularly keen on, if it could happen, is the rumoured, if PSG can bring in a central midfielder, is getting Christopher Nkunku out of there, who is a really versatile player, almost as positionally flexible as Maitland-Niles in that he has played right wing back, even right back, not totally convincingly, but in the right system could be a good attacking outlet down the flank. He's definitely a box-to-box midfielder who can also drop in a sort of more deep playmaking role and, of course, can play on both flanks in an attacking third and has done so for PSG, both in central midfield and in a wider role with some effectiveness, particularly under Unai Emery. You know, if the rumoured fees are correct, initial loan and then to buy fee of between 10 and 15 million, I'd be happy with that because given his age, he wouldn't count against our squad number limits at this stage. And he's exactly the sort of profile of player in terms of athleticism and flexibility that would suit Unai Emery, but also would prove a solid investment for the club going forward, unless he suddenly drops off a cliff, which does happen occasionally, but would be in contrary to his career trajectory to date. Again, we're pretty close to the transfer window closing, but we still have no great idea about what's going to happen. But I would definitely favour bringing in Nkunku, as I said. Obviously, we're now, in the last few days, getting linked to everyone and his mother, who might be available on a loan, and whether the club will succeed in any of those things really depends on dominoes falling elsewhere. There have been rumours about Perisic being loaned in as an exchange for Ozil being loaned out to Milan, into Milan, but I don't see that likely to happen. I don't think that really resolves any problems for either team, and is just both teams making a short-term fix to deal with a temporary problem. Something that's even more far-fetched has been talk of a swap deal between Ozil and Adrien Rabiot out of PSG. PSG don't have that control. Adrien Rabiot can sign a pre-contract with anyone he likes, and given that he's consistently rumoured to be signing a pre-contract with Barcelona, it seems very much the case that that is not something that's going to happen. Obviously, if we were able to acquire the player, I'd be delighted, but the chances of that actually having anything to do with Mesut Ozil and the chances of it happening are both very, very slim. He does obviously has worked very well under Unai Emery, and being frozen out at PSG, all you can do as Arsenal fans is hope that nostalgia leads to some surprising decision-making on behalf of the player and his agents come the summer, because I think Rabiot is an excellent footballer who would bring a lot to this team. Again, can perform more than one role as well. He can play that deep-lying playmaker role, which he did under Emery, but also a box-to-box role. And at a push, can play as a sort of more defensively aware number 10. He's got size, he's got great stamina. You know, he'd be a great signing for us, but as I said before, I don't see it happening. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens from the last couple of days of this transfer window, and also, obviously, in the coming summer, because these were the first chances really for Emery to try and have an influence in shaping the squad that fits the way that he wants a squad to work. You know, people talk about players that came in this summer, but a number of those players were signed before Emery had agreed to join the club. Sokratis, Lichtsteiner being cases in point, possibly even Torreira, who I'm sure is a player that Emery would have been aware of, but I think that deal was probably done beforehand. And same with Leno. But Guendouzi does seem to be one that Emery had a major influence over, and that's worked out quite well. And again, there is a player that he can play a sort of box-to-box role, he can play a sort of deep-sitting role, and he's got the potential to perform well in the future in either of those roles, because he's got a good range of passing, but he's got a great engine. So if that's the kind of profile of player we're looking at to be bringing into the club going forward, it's reasons to be optimistic. Elsewhere in Arsenal land, or Arsenal-related land, there are a few little things that are worth mentioning, but probably not worth going into massive detail about. But the Arsenal ladies won 3-0 away at Reading on Sunday, which means, having lost disappointingly to Chelsea recently and lost their top spot in the Women's Premier League, they are now back up to second with a game in hand over the two teams around them. The other notable thing from the game was that Vivian Miedema has now set the record for the most number of goals in a Women's Premier League season. Well, admittedly, they've not been going that well. But, yeah, I mean, there's still a few games left. And, I mean, she's been absolutely brilliant for the Arsenal ladies. And a proper centre forward, as if you will. The table stands at the moment with Manchester City, who played 14, won 10, drawn 4, 34 points, goal difference of plus 32. Arsenal in second, played 13, won 11, lost 2, 33 points, goal difference of plus 39. And then Chelsea and Birmingham City both on 28 points after 14 games with goal differences of 13 and 7 respectively. So it really is between the top two at this stage, unless either of them collapse. And Arsenal just about have the upper hand, although Man City's ladies remain unbeaten. So if for those of you that follow the women's team, it's a really exciting title race, and of course, and Arsenal are in a very strong position within it, despite having had this endless selection of injuries, most notably Jordan Nobbs basically doing an ACL, which is a massive blow both for her and for the England women at the World Cup. But it was nice to see her doing a bit of telework and greeting all the Arsenal women's players as they came off the pitch, and lots of tweets about that going round. Elsewhere, it seems that happily, Lauren Koscielny does not have a broken jaw, hooray, but might still need some minor surgery in order to sort out the bruising and possibly a blood clot that would have formed in that area. It does mean he's unlikely to play for us against Cardiff tomorrow night, or tonight by the time you'll be hearing this, which means we'll be likely to see Mavropanos back in the Arsenal team for the first time since his sending off at the back end of last season. Now he's back from injury, he's played sort of, well, basically a game for the under-23s. We have to hope he's not too rusty, because although Cardiff are not the best team in the Premier League by any stretch of the imagination, they have a physical and pacey front line, and could give us some problem. Elsewhere, nice to see the Sun are still fuckbags, and yes, they're still racist, because they're basically doing a takedown piece on Joe Willock, basically trying to make a massive scandal of the fact that he had consensual sex with a French model who agreed to have sex with him, and then very cheaply sort of sold a story about how he was not that mature. Unsurprising, he's 19, love. How many 19-year-old boys do you know who are mature, particularly if you're used to having sexual relations with men of a slightly more advanced age? Ashley Cole being a case in point, which of course added a certain extra spice to the story. Needs to say, the Sun used that to try and desperately reignite their utterly disinterested hippie cracks story, which no one calls it fucking hippie crap, you losers. And needless to say, no one's remotely interested. But it's nice to see that if you have sex with a woman consensually in a way that everyone is relatively content with as a white footballer, no one mentions it. But if you're a young black footballer living in London, you're still a target. Good work, fuckbags. Yes, it seems just elsewhere, just to clarify, we can't take Callum Chambers back on loan. There's been lots of people talking about it, but it's not physically possible. We agreed to deal with Fulham till the end of the season, and ultimately, long term, it's probably for the best. Even if short term, it's not going to do us much good. Of course, looking talking about other loan players, one of the things that will probably factor into the club's decision to want to try and bring in a wide player on loan this season is obviously they want to see what where Reece Nelson's at his development when he comes back to the club in the summer after his loan spell at Hoffenheim. Started like a house on fire, but in recent weeks, well, just before Christmas, slowed down a bit and is nursing a little bit of a back injury, so hasn't been able to play for Hoffenheim in their last couple of games. But obviously he has to factor into our thinking going forward, particularly as we got him to sign a new contract, and we don't want to repeat what's happening elsewhere in the Premier League, which is young, talented players desperate to go and play in Germany on a full-time basis because they can't get a look in at their English clubs. Jadon Sancho and soon-to-be Callum Hudson-Odoi being cases in point. Elsewhere, not masses going on. Obviously, Thierry Henry got sacked by Monaco in a move that surprised absolutely nobody. It's one thing sort of giving abuse to an opposition player. If you're a player, if you're a manager, it's not a good look, particularly if your team is losing to everybody. He took over Monaco when they were 19th. They're still 19th, but now they've sacked him and brought back the bloke they sacked to bring him in, and have basically spent about £16 million on severance packages in the process. Genius work at board level there. You've got to have some sympathy for Henry. I mean, yes, he probably wasn't ready for a job of that magnitude, given he's never managed anywhere before, and given that he is a strong personality, the accusations of arrogance were always inevitable given the way he communicates as well, and given he's actually quite old school in quite a lot of his attitudes towards discipline and things like that. But, I mean, if we think we've got injuries bad, I mean, the Monaco team sheets that were going out under much of Thierry's time in charge were basically occasionally Radamel Falcao and Sidibe at right back, and then a whole load of people you've never heard of because they're all from the youth team, because basically they had about 14 players injured. So having sold all their superstars from that amazing title run, they then invested about half that money back in, you know, some of the most promising young players around Europe. But of course, if you're in a dogfight, you don't want promising young players who've never been in a dogfight before. You need some old heads as well. And the balance has been wrong. And then half those players have been injured as well. I think a number of those players could still go on and had great careers, players like Yuri Tillemans and Golovin and what have you. But yeah, whoever was managing things strategically at Monaco in the last 18 months has made a spectacular series of cock-ups, which has resulted in them now, halfway through the season, being in the relegation zone, having to hire back the bloke that took them to the relegation zone in the first place because none of the original players wanted him to go the first time round, which also limited Thierry's ability to have an impact there. I've seen some crowing on the internet about, oh, it serves him right, he was angling after Wenger's job, blah, 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 blah. Ultimately, if we loved him as a player, we should want him to do well as a coach, partly because he clearly loves Arsenal, and so any success he has may have some positive benefit with us, partly because would be nice to have more managers out there who actually have positive dealings with Arsenal, so, you know, whether it's loan agreements or transfer agreements or whatever, but not having to deal with people like Pulis and Allardyce any more than is necessary, and dealing with people who are more sympathetically disposed to us would make a nice change. Elsewhere, after rumours he was going to come back to Arsenal as a coach, José Antonio Reyes has now gone to Extremadura. I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't really know. A Spanish second division team, so he's not coming back to coach at Arsenal. Also this week, after the Cardiff game, our 13 years head groundsman is leaving to start up, not to go to a rival, but to set up his own business, trying to revolutionise the way that football pitches are maintained. One can only hope and presume the club has someone lined up in as a replacement for that, but we shall have to wait and see. Elsewhere, Jens Lehmann has got a job at Augsburg, who are in the relegation zone in Germany. I mean, they have much lower budget than a lot of their rival teams and have been punching above their weight for a couple of years now. And he's been put on the coaching staff there. Nice to see him back in work, particularly given the way that he was unceremoniously shoved out of Arsenal when Wenger left for reasons that we cannot know from the outside. And, I mean, the long and the short of it, that's about it. Yeah, there's not much else going on. Obviously, we've got Cardiff coming up. I mean, that has to be a game that we that we feel confident about winning, given our respective positions, and given that despite all our defensive injuries, Arsenal still have a lot to offer going forward, and Cardiff are limited, although earnest, in their efforts. They may well stay up, but then they are a team that, frankly, if they're in 18th position in the league and with a goal difference of 41 worse than ours, we should really try and be expecting to beat them in a home match. That obviously kicks off at 7:45 on Tuesday night, which hopefully will be the time that you guys will be listening to this. And then after that, we've got the small matter of away at Man City at the weekend with no defenders. Could get ugly. All the more reason to try and get 3 points against Cardiff. And then after that, the fixtures get a little bit friendlier for Arsenal, because then we've got Huddersfield away, Bartek Borisov in the Europa League twice, Southampton at home and Bournemouth at home. So Man City's a really horrible start to February, but February could be a good month, which is what we need, because then in March we've got away at Spurs, home to Man United and away at Wolves, which is going to be three very tricky fixtures. April looks a bit kinder, with Everton, Watford and Leicester being the away games, Palace and Newcastle being the home games. And then May, obviously, we've got Brighton at home and Burnley away to finish the season. I mean, I don't even want to talk about the Man City game, frankly. They've had their little stutter, but they're still looking pretty imperious. And it's going to take a bit of tactical intelligence from Unai Emery to get out of that one with anything. Particularly given that we're likely to be having a back four of either Jenkinson or Lichtsteiner, or perhaps Maitland-Niles. Mustafi, Mavropanos and Kolasinac. Yeah, how do you fancy that, them apples? All right, well, I'm going to knock it on the head for this week. You don't want to listen to just me talking for any longer than I've just been talking. Hopefully we'll have more people to talk to again next week. I'm hoping that in February and March we're going to get more guests on to come and join us, so you can have more experts talking in, well, more expertly about a greater range of topics. Either way, I hope you all have a lovely week, and we'll be back again next week. Here's hoping that we get out of this week with at least 3 points, preferably 4 or 6. Ha! Hope springs. All right, cheerio.